Do you ever wonder who wrote those things? Like you hear them and you know you wrote them and then somebody else say them and you think, oh, that's nice. Oh, right.
Very nice.
Thank you, Sandra, right?
Sarah.
Yes. Sarah, thank you. And thanks to Rahela for facilitating our presence here today. And just wanted to first say by saying thank you for having me here because I'm a new, I think I called myself an affiliate, but what am I?
Associate
of the center. So it has much more meaning now that I'm standing here doing this. And Sarah Redrum I've been working with, so it's been great to get to know the work of the center and some of the people here through working with Sarah. So just want to say thank you for that invitation. So Kelly is a doctoral student I'm working with, and she wasn't necessarily participating in this research, but as all of you know, and we'll say more about it, when you do qualitative research, the project ends, but the analysis and the thinking doesn't. So it's kind of great, it's been great for us to work together in relation to a project that Kelly wasn't actually involved in, but it keeps showing up as having relevance in the current maternity care practice context in BC now. So this was, I'm going to tell you about a study that I was involved in over a 4-year period that ended in, data collection ended in 2008. But I can assure you that the stories of the women and what we learned have another life today in terms of everywhere we go and talk about them. It seems as though the study is ongoing, which is a great opportunity in qualitative work to say. Your knowledge translation activities extend far beyond the end of the study. So the topic today is actually, you probably picked up on in terms of the bio, so I'll tell you about the study. And then what we wanted to talk with you about today, because I thought, thinking about who was in the room, this what happens when you take your findings out into the larger world, and how important it is for us to be able to think about how people respond and take up and resist or refute what we've learned in order to have this ongoing professional discourse in healthcare. So we're going to share with you our experience of taking our findings out, but it'd be really hard to do that without telling you about the study first. So this was a study that was a partnership, an interdisciplinary study on maternity care. So we had a counseling psychologist, so Marla Buchanan. Hello,
welcome.
Marla Buchanan, who's here at UBC in the counseling psychology faculty. A family physician who works in the Department of Family Medicine. Myself in the School of Nursing, Colleen Barco, who's been associated with the center in the past. So we came together as an interdisciplinary team. And just want to acknowledge our community researchers who can't always be at all of our presentations, but usually are, and those are the women listed at the bottom. So the Maternity Care Project was funded by CHR, and the BC Centre of Excellence for Women's Health was the administrator and holder of the grant, but it was also in the collaboration with the Department of Family Medicine here at UBC. And it was a partnership-based project with four Aboriginal communities in BC. So just off the northern tip of Vancouver Island is the community of Alert Bay, and the Numglees First Nation live in Alert Bay. So that was one of the communities. We had two communities in Haida Gwaii, Old Masset, and Old Masset is where the Red Star is. However, it's not on any of our downloadable maps, but Masset is because that's the non-Aboriginal community. So we can't even get it on here. I suppose if I had good tech skills, I could superimpose it on this map. But so Masset is up at the tip, Rose Spit, which is right at the top of the Northern Island in Haida Gwaii, and Skidigit, which is where the plane flies in and out, if you've ever flown into Haida Gwaii, or taking the ferry from Prince Rupert, and Ballacoola, so which is in the Vancouver Coastal Health Region. I think it's far up, but it's not that far up. They always say, we're not that far up. So Ballacoola, which is at the end of the long inlet. So these four communities were communities that had, through various forms, had started to express dissatisfaction with maternity care. And so the study was born out of what was learned in those communities about women having a whole variety of experiences in childbearing. So the study wasn't necessarily born from a gap in knowledge, and I know this isn't a methodology seminar, but I found as a practicing nurse who's usually got her ear and her feet pretty close to the ground that the justification for research comes from a variety of places. And so when public discourse is you know, available and accessible, and we start hearing about the impact of certain changes in healthcare delivery, that's often a site of study, as many of you know. And so There was a number of things in 2002, 2003 that were happening in these four communities that created a degree of sort of public outcry, if you will, around maternity service delivery. Primarily, it was constructed in the media as evacuation, but if you peel back the top layer of the media, you find it wasn't necessarily about evacuation. Some women were fine to stay, but the services were inadequate in terms of how they were treated. So there were a whole variety of things were happening, and there was a sort of public outcry around maternity care service delivery in rural communities. But then we also know that there are lots of voices missing in healthcare delivery contexts in certain areas such as maternity care. And so we know that in particular rural and Aboriginal women's voices are lacking in terms of moving services forward. So it was a sort of had two underpinnings in terms of getting the study going. So this is the team. That's a mixture of us academics and the community-based researchers in the project over the four-year period. And just one of the things I wanted to just add, because it's sort of the justification for, it helps me locate myself in terms of work in maternity care, is certainly around women's reproductive health. There's a tendency in the women's health field to never reduce women's health purely to reproductive function. And we would all accept that, we also know that childbearing experiences have this legacy and lasting effect beyond the immediate period of 9 months. And so that is, in particular in relation to Kelly's work, even while considering having children and fertility and that whole experience. But that as a site of analysis of women's health, it's an important one because it has a temporal dimension and a trajectory that is long-standing in women's lives. So not reducible to women's health is reducible to reproductive health, but we also sometimes what happens is we say, well then, you know, we'll pay less attention to reproduction because it's had such a dominant focus and a conflation with women's health. But at the same time, we need to understand women's experiences because of the trajectory over time. And for any of you that have your ear close to the ground around early maternity discharge, we know that in order to get women out sooner, we've got a much longer trajectory now of women running into trouble at home earlier without support. So you know, the trajectory shifts and changes with the policy and practice context. But for me, it is about that, the legacy and the impact on women over time. And that's just in relation to women generally. So this project was driven by these three questions. Particularly, we were interested in how the erosion of maternity care has affected Aboriginal women, families, and communities. We were specifically focused on First Nations women. But we maintained the term Aboriginal because of, at times, the women talked about a shared legacy of colonial history that they wanted to be identified as Aboriginal women where necessary, and specifically First Nations women when we talked about their home communities. So we were interested in women's experiences from these rural communities, and then we were doing that to think about particularly strengthening birthing and maternity. We had a sub-agenda of the policy context analysis, but we, in order for us to work together and kind of all know what we were doing, we always seemed to language our questions in a way that we got us all on the same page. But we had a policy kind of agenda. So we began the study, and I know it's not new news to anybody sitting here, but we began the study in the first year focused specifically on developing our methodology. So we knew what we wanted to study, but the how we had to sort out as people engage from different places, from different histories, from different communities, and where the whole backdrop with non-Aboriginal academics in rural communities, what we needed to do is spend a year together acknowledging how the colonial context of academic work is relevant in this project. Where are we beginning? What's our starting point? And the women reminded us often that we began in mistrust. So we actually started with the acknowledgement of harm. And so in the beginning of the project, there was a lot of talk about how do you know you won't take what you need to know to further your own careers? So we pretty much had a year of conversation about past harms. And it was interesting because CIHR didn't like the fact that the grant had a year of methodology development. Which is really quite fascinating because we all know That's not just what you're studying, it's what how you're doing it. But we almost didn't get the grant because we had too much team building. And even though we said, look at the context, right, and what we want to pay attention to. So we began, and mistrust as often being our the words that ground us and remind us. That's not a bad thing. That's a good place because we now know what we're now know how we're working together. So it was a community-based participatory study, primarily driven by the principles of Peter Reason and Patty Lather. So we combined a feminist orientation to community-based methods with a participatory approach. And in particular in relation to the colonial context of academic work and research in communities, we were driven by, we use the term neo-colonial theoretical perspectives because oftentimes the women we were working with, if we ever said post-colonial, it's so interesting because we knew the critiques of that term, post is not over, right? They often encourage us to say ongoing colonialism. So often in some of our publications we've used those words, but the other one that is familiar is neocolonial. So I just put a couple of examples here, and it's not really the findings of the project, but I think the methodology is often the findings of the project in addition to what the data tells you. But a couple of examples are we set out with I think the intent that we would run focus groups, and we had focus group questions, and the women had helped us. And about 6 months into the study, they said, like, I don't know, these questions don't feel like me. Could I just go in and be me? And we often had conversations about how our responses would be telling. Can you go in and be just you? Absolutely you can. These are not new skills. So one of the papers we've written is, and the community researchers were the leads on it, is this really research? This whole notion that these are skills and intuitions and they're part of our history and our community, how can you come in and call this research? Because this is what we know, this is how we engage with our people. And the other principle that was very instructive, I think, as we proceeded is if we actually stopped and listened, people had a lot to say. So that was important because of the notion of the obligation of the researcher to really have the best questions to get at human experience. And the women often reminded us that that's arrogant, basically. It's not how good your questions are. It's a trust in the impulse to narrate and the impulse to speak to human experience. So stop worrying about your questions so much and focus on that. And we were reminded constantly that you can't come and take our stories, that we need to be an integral part of how those stories are not just represented, but the places that they go. So that first year was, I think, pretty foundational. And so it seems always like the platform is really set unless I provide that. One of our lead community researchers, people in the community often said, it's so great, you're running the project, this is so great. And she used to say, just because she can't be here today and it's so great. I've been doing this work for a long time. I always do this work. It's like the course you're teaching, but you've always been teaching the course because it's your politics. So you, and then as my colleague Colleen says, they give me a different course, but I always teach the same course. This is kind of what she was saying. I've been doing this work, and the recognition of being paid as a community researcher was, as many of you know, really, it's important, and now I know it. Because somebody's going to pay, and it's coming from CIHR. She also reminded us often about, you know, the importance of developing these skills, because she said, well, I'm doing the work anyway, and if I'm not going to do the work, I'll be sitting around my kitchen table complaining. So here I go. So I'm trying to bring her here. So all of that is to say, oh, I did it in 50 minutes. That was my goal. This is all, a lot of this is published in this lovely new book that is coming out of the center and has a number of authors. All of us are in this chapter, and then Marla, I think, is in another chapter. So I would say this is a very effective representation of all of the things we're talking about and all the uncertainties as well as what we know and all of the risks and harms. So I thought it'd be the first place I could go and plug the book.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And it's 40% off for a while if you buy it soon or something. I didn't read the details. But so we had 103 people in the communities across those four rural settings, focus groups and individual interviews. And some of them were individual interviews, not set up and in somebody's home, but we have a number of transcripts where people met in the grocery store, and then they said, you know, somebody said to Vera, oh, I have something to say. And Vera said the best recruitment strategy was just being out in the community. She was kind of identified as being related to the study in birthing. And she'd call people and they'd say no. So we learned a lot about recruitment. Oh, and I went up to the community and I kind of stand out a bit when I'm up there. And we always use that as an opportunity. So I got invited to play on this basketball, in this exhibition basketball game with a bunch of youth because they were short players. And I have played and I'm tall. So I thought, oh, I'll go in and play in this basketball game. And it was great fun with a whole bunch of youth. And then after the study, I was there for a couple, or after the game, a couple more days, I had 12 youth come up and say, you playing the game, what are you doing here anyway? Like, oh, I'm here on a study. Oh, I'll be in the project. So we're also writing a paper about that. You know, just, I mean, we talk about participation. We get that. Well, that meant throwing myself around like a fool in a basketball game with a bunch of youth that could run circles around me. But we ended up with 12 youth in the project. So. And I did feel quite ridiculous because I was a bit rusty, but they were great. And that notion of, and it's different than ethnographic, you know, inside, like we have all that reading, but for me this really was like, okay, now I know what you're talking about. Get your shoes on and just pick up your bootstraps and go for it. So individual interviews and conversations where we had consent forms always in our pocket and a tape recorder and a willingness to just be in places, I think that's what we reflected on. We also showed up in any places that the community researchers or participants said, you should go there, without even asking why. Just go there, sit at the mom and baby drop-in, and watch, listen, learn, be curious. Because oftentimes it was those of us that were non-Aboriginal women who are academics, and primarily all of Euro-Canadian descent, just our very presence was a bit like, oh, So people were curious in often in a very positive way, and that opened up opportunities. So it is that idea of awareness of privilege and positionality, enlisting that in a way that was helpful for the study, I think, and helped us connect with people. So we began the study. This is probably one of the first important findings that we actually started with this simple notion of taking birthing experiences seriously. So much of the work in the interviews was about listening and recording, but the presence of, we believe you have your story is an important story to tell. And so for anybody that has had a baby or been around somebody that's had a baby, you actively look for places to tell your story for whatever human meaning-making reasons. It helps you make sense, it helps you reflect. Actually lodge memories, I think, is some of the things I've read. You actually want to create a memory bank, so telling your story just allows you to continue to reify in positive ways the experience and come to terms with questions that still remain. So in many of the instances, that was primarily our first finding, if you will, or insight, is that there was something really powerful about taking birthing stories seriously. Because of the focus of the study, it was attending and listening to birthing experiences, but always in relation to these other critical dimensions of women's lives, history, community, motherhood, experiences of motherhood or images of motherhood or discourses on motherhood, always all at once was our kind of our methodologic strategy. Birthing and life all at once, all the time. So that meant always following many paths simultaneously in a qualitative interview, which can be challenging yet important. Culture and tradition, issues of power, colonial relations and racism. So in every interview, these aspects of women's lives and their experiences was showed up in different quotes, in different sort of reflective pieces. A primary thread through all the data, which is, I'm sure, not a surprise, is that there is no understanding in contemporary context without historical, without the role of history. And we were reminded over and over about, particularly around birthing, you know, Western Western approaches to the management of pregnancy were, and how important it was to see that those practices and policies and the shift towards more biomedical constructions of childbirth were told it would be better for you. In the women's word, not only is it better for you, you really need us. That the construction of you really need what Western medicine can offer you, which the women knew in the interviews was getting in the way of good outcomes. That there was a knowing that wasn't tapped in that situation. So we heard a lot about the economic context of birthing, and the women talked about the collapse of the fishing industry in many of these communities had created an economic collapse, which I'm sure, again, you know about. But the idea that absolute or relative poverty created a condition of powerlessness, again, no surprise, but that led women to feel they had less rights to lobby for what they wanted and needed in childbirth. So this larger economics played out in terms of women's capacity to lobby and advocate for themselves, not so much during birth, but as birth was impending. And I'll say a little bit more about that. So these were many of their words. Poverty has no power. When you're becoming a mom, you need your power. Well, at any point, but particularly when you're lobbying to stay in your community if there's a threat of evacuation. And a variety of other experiences in relation to economics. We also heard about disruption of birthing traditions. Again, there's been a fair amount written about disconnections from indigenous practices has put women at risk because certain knowledges and practices have not been passed on, and many of those knowledges and practices that have not been passed on have been historically linked to good outcomes. So the Aboriginal midwifery movement has certainly moved the plate, has found a place to argue for the legitimacy of indigenous knowledge and practices in childbirth. The missing gap is showing how those make a difference to positive outcomes, because we still have an outcomes agenda driving much of maternity care, but it's premised on a certain understanding of outcomes. Anyway, this isn't about outcomes, but just probably can't not say that. So we heard a lot about what we used to do, and an intuitive knowledge about how to be supporting a woman in pregnancy, or to be learning from the ancestors and from aunties about how to labor and give birth. They talked a lot about we never laid around, and why do we have these bed? I mean, many women are ambulating during labor, but a lot of women, first thing you do when you go in the room is just hop up here. I know, because I was a nurse in those areas, and I can say that. No, it's not them. I did it too. Just hop up here, and can I get up there? No, I'm not quite finished your assessment. You need to just... So we heard, I guess in an overarching way, this is sort of a summary, that women felt they had no power, no choice, and control. So that is different than the evacuation discourse that is quite prevalent. Rural women shouldn't have to leave communities. Well, sometimes they were fine to leave. It was the issue of power, choice, and control, which I don't think is a huge surprise. Some women said, and these voices didn't really end up in the media to the same degree, oh yeah, no, I have a sister that lives in Williams Lake. I was good to go. No, and I have a place to stay. I have lots of family there. I was fine. So the evacuation discourse was quite powerful because it silenced a certain kind of resiliency and agency in women that were fine to go. But they were working the evacuation policy context to their advantage, right? They were working it in ways that created possibilities that worked for them. So they, power, no choice, control were across these dimensions. Timing, who was there, how birth was managed, costs, preparation for birth. So across all of those dimensions, a feeling of no power, no choice, no control. And then we heard, not surprising, about the number one condition within which good outcomes, used loosely, or good experiences evolved, were the attitudes of healthcare providers. And they used the words attitudes, but what we know from, what I know from being a healthcare provider is that there is no single attitude, that your practices are shaped in this larger social context. So. This, even though we heard a lot about attitudes, we knew it was attitudes up, further up through the various systems and structures that held the maternity care practices in place in the community. And there was a consistent theme, particularly in Bella Coola. And the interesting thing is about why I'm naming the communities is that the community said it would be unethical not to name them. They wanted to be named. So we actually had submitted an ethics proviso to name the communities because of the misrepresentation by non-naming, right? So the Bella Coola women and community members that were supported of the study and the researchers said, this is from our community and we want the world to know that. That there was differential treatment in moments of newborn care, particularly because of the they get it all for free or have not credibility. And this is one of the first times we started thinking about this discrediting of women in their birthing experiences. We also heard a lot about women that took matters into their own hands and decided they weren't going to get evacuated, so they would just stay home until the baby's head was imminent and nobody could send them out in active labor, or if they were beyond the crowning point, or so they would take matters into their own hands and create situations that would lead to the impossibility of evacuation. And we heard a lot in Haida Gwaii about women walking the beach, and one of the elders said, oh yeah, there goes so-and-so walking the beach trying to avoid evacuation. So, and many of these communities, in particular, two of them had birthing facilities, because there was no skilled attendant, there was no birthing in those two communities, yet the equipment was there. So they knew that if they showed up and the equipment was there, that and they couldn't be evacuated, that they still likely would have a good outcome. If there was no equipment and no people, then women often didn't engage in sort of taking matters into their own hands. So they describe stressful birth as being as a whole variety of manifestations of disconnection, loss of a hope for birth, the sort of impending gloom and doom, depression that came with knowing you were going to be separated from family and community, if that in fact was the case, and a loss of both immediate and impending safety and security if they were in fact going to be away from supports and family. So while I don't want to necessarily say that the issues were all about evacuation, there were lots of stories about leaving home that were significant. Leaving family, and one woman talked about it, it's like when the pavers get set for leaving, it's like a sweater that you get hooked and it just keeps unraveling because you start to pull away some of those fundamental connections and it creates a sort of a ripple effect of, and one woman talked about, as soon as I knew I wouldn't be near my granny, I started to wonder if I had the strength myself. So this unraveling experience was quite powerful. And then women talked a lot about, is it that much to ask? And at the same time, of course, in the community, people are saying things like, well, it's for we need to protect your baby. And we know that if there's not X number of births in this community, that people can't keep their skills up. So it's for your own good. So it's the tension between wanting to birth in community, but also wanting to safeguard their pregnancies and their fetus as he or she comes to term. But there was also this fundamental lack of consideration for the importance of birthing in home territory. So in the maternity care policy context, connections to home and community are not necessarily a variable, because the variable that is dominant is protection of maternal fetal risk. In Alert Bay, they now have a sort of way of determining risk status. And so if it's a low-risk second pregnancy, the women go down to Courtney Comox. If it's a first pregnancy, so there's all these, it's sort of an algorithm around first, second, low, high, and the least amount of risk allows them to give birth closest to home, which is Courtney Comox, which is still about 3 hours to get over in the ferry and down. And so this is quite, in Alert Bay, this is a plane that crashed on a wharf the wharf's not attached to the island anymore. So the women took this picture of, this signifies, or this is maternity care policy. There's a crashed plane and a wharf that's not connected. So so we did actually have some photo voice in the for women that didn't want to have interviews. And just kind of moving towards wrapping up here, is, I don't know if anybody is doing work in postpartum depression. But we heard a lot about the social, economic, political context of postnatal depression, and which is interesting given that most of what we do for women in the antenatal period is screen them for antenatal depression as a predictor of postnatal depression. Well, women talked about getting the postpartum depression because of this loss of power, choice, and control undermined their capacity, which created a set of conditions within which they understood themselves being at risk for postnatal depression. I said that at a conference, and they said, well, so did they say that caused the postnatal depression, like being away from home? No, it didn't. That's not the point. The point is their experience created a set of conditions within which their capacity and agency and sense of confidence was undermined. Now, I don't know if that's causally linked to postnatal depression, but I can tell you, as a mother, when you don't feel you're doing a very good job, the dark clouds roll in pretty fast. So what we were trying to say in this paper is that there are a larger set of conditions of women's lives, such as many of you know, colonial history, that we need to start interrogating around incidents of postnatal depression. Because then our possibilities to treat PND will start to shift, because now we have cognitive behavioral therapy and drugs. So the women I'm working with in Alert Bay are doing an Indigenous-centered mental health program for mothers and babies, trying to just not rehabilitate old traditions, but to actually learn from old traditions and find new ways in contemporary times to support mothering to deal with the issue of postnatal depression. So they talked about a good birth, meaning a supportive family, respectful staff, affordable food. We have all kinds of details. I did bring actually two reports because I only had two. But if anybody would like the full report, I can make more copies and bring them back to the center here, because there's more detail than probably. And nurses and physicians engaging with them in ways they can understand. So in summary, this is sort of how the whole, this was our analysis through women's experiences. The conditions within which their birthing experiences are here on your left, that set in place the conditions for women's avoidance of care, the power, nutrition, and control, stressful birth, and then further set in place conditions for particular health outcomes. So just as you hear that, this is also what we know. This is what some of current evidence tells us, is that we have across most indicators, we have birth outcomes as 2 to 5 times worse for Aboriginal women. So these are the indicators like maternal morbidity, mortality, low birth weight, preterm birth rate. These are some of the main ones. SIDS, rates of SIDS and threats to infant safety are sort of finding their way into the health indicator language. But you start to unravel a bit of a different story. I think that's my point in putting this up, is I go to lots of places where people say, well, look how bad the outcomes are. And you stand there and say, you know, there's a set of conditions here that often we don't unravel far enough or with the same scope or depth that we need to start considering. And if we're going to actually make a difference in health outcomes, we probably see some points of action and entry that are quite critical. That report is actually on that website if anybody's interested. I just have to say, in one of the reports it said that in Alberta, the outcomes for non-Aboriginal women were approximating those of Aboriginal women because, this is a quote, because of proximity, period. So yeah, I can find that report if anybody needs it. That non-Aboriginal women's, rural non-Aboriginal Albertan women's outcomes in this one area are approximating those of Aboriginal women, and this could likely be due to proximity, period. So, I mean, not only is it about how they're constructed in relation to their own for those population health indicators, but then those conclusions drawn from those indicators. So yes, the data was done in '08, '09, but it keeps going. So just now to shift a little bit around the maternity care policy context, because I think that's really, I think, our place of saying there is a larger set of discourses that are constructing women subjectivity, their agency and capacity in relation to childbearing. And we heard a lot about if you're not birthing in your community, there's a lot of death. In the four communities we worked in, there's a lot of death. A lot of natural death, a lot of deaths due to suicide, MVAs. Not to say there's more death, but there's a lot of death. There's a lot of, and that without birth, it's too hard. It's just too hard. So that is a really, I'm just going to skip ahead here because I want to just shift towards this idea of crediting and discrediting maternity care policy context. We also know that women sometimes got induced and were booked for C-sections in the instance when care providers were in the community. So if there was one in in Bella Coola, the physicians were there for 1 week and not for the other three. So women, if they wanted to stay home, at times were induced in order to give birth at home, and at other times they were scheduled for C-section. So there was a policy context around scheduling and induction that was constructed as giving women choices. So this has started where we start to start to unravel this notion of crediting, discrediting, which meant there was actually disrespect for anything that they would construct as a real choice. There's choice, and then there's real choice. And women were choosing in a context that actually incurred risk in some situations. All right. So, Kelly.
Right.
Sorry, we had to find something funny because we've had this ongoing conversation about what happens when you go out to conferences and you say what we've just said.
Yeah. So, this past summer, I had the opportunity to present this report for Helen at SOGC, which is the National Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada. So physicians, nurses from around the country who work in maternity care come together every year and have this conference. So I presented this report, and it was a really fantastic opportunity, and I was really excited about sharing these stories, because it was so great, and I thought, and it was in a session for aimed at nurses, but some physicians were there as well, who work in rural maternity settings. So it was actually in a sub-section. So I figured people were coming would probably be aware of this kind of stuff, and it'd be nice for them to see what Helen and her group had found. So I gave this report, and I had, you know, along the way, I was starting to get some indicators that maybe I wasn't quite coming across the way I was hoping to, or maybe they weren't seeing it as I was seeing it. When I had physicians stop and ask me, well, you know, how many births were there, and what were the numbers, and how did you sample? And I thought, okay, maybe I need to kind of try to, you know, clarify. And I kept going, and at the end, a woman identified herself as an obstetrician who works in a rural area, and she said, this happens to my patients all the time. They have to drive in, and you don't hear white women complaining, so why is this different? What's the problem? Mm-hmm. And I probably had a look like that on my face. How do I respond to this? And I think I was so surprised, and not that I don't think I'm naive. I recognize that there's still racism in the world, and that we still have problems in British Columbia in particular, our relationships with some of these communities. But I didn't expect in that context, working with healthcare providers who provide health in rural areas. I think that the section was even titled Aboriginal Rural Care, wasn't it? I think. Mm-hmm. So I really was shocked in that context, you know, that I was getting this response, and how do I respond? And so that led Helen and I to then have lots of conversations around what do you do with this. So this study was over in 2007, 2008, and through disseminating the information, we're still getting these kinds of responses, so there's still work to be done. And that sort of led us to this idea of almost a secondary analysis, not just of the findings, but of how those findings are taken up and how people are responding to them.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's quite funny, if you Google images, what the bleep, you find all these little, and it was interesting because, you know, Kelly called me, she said, oh, somebody said this, and I thought, you know, it's not, like, I believe it's alive and well, we didn't necessarily talk through because sometimes you think, well, where am I going? You know, you kind of wonder, but it made me realize that the work of KT is this, right? It's standing up there, maybe not saying that, but that's probably counter to, you know.
I think I had a polite response at the time, and it was afterwards, because maybe not so polite.
But it was so interesting, because I said, oh, that's so interesting, that one comment. There is so much, that comment is so important for us, right? It is a what, but it's such an important site now to jump off from in terms of where this work goes. So we didn't necessarily look at constructions of subjectivity in the neo-colonial context. That really wasn't we really wanted to take birthing stories seriously. And we did that, and that was our entry point. But what we need to do now is look at how in the sharing of women's experiences and stories in the study, the larger discursive processes that are constructing who they are and what they deserve, and if, in fact, they have some rights to complaining in response to this. So that led us back to Mary Ellen Calm's work. It led me back, because she coined this term medical colonialism, and it's sort of like, so it's colonialism in another form, right? It's how colonialism continues in the medical establishment or in healthcare practice. And so, at least this is a tax-paying baby, is medical colonialism. So it really is about interrogating the medical talk and text. And I don't even like to say medical, because that sounds like we're just talking about physician healthcare talk and text for these ongoing constructions that have history and are continuing to play out in professional discourse. So I think that's important because the rationale was about risk reduction. And yet what we know is in this very context, we are creating risk. And I know I didn't get to the risk thing last year that Sarah was leading, but I know that's what she was talking about. And so risk is even in quotations for that reason. In healthcare, we call it the iatrogenic construction of risk, which is kind of cool. So there's you know what that means? Like when you go to hospital and you get an infection that is hospital-borne, it's called an iatrogenic. So system-generated harms, iatrogenic harm and suffering. Really, as a healthcare provider, if you hear that, you know you played a role in it, as did the policies and the practices. But we have a certain construction of women in this response that has its roots in both past, I think, and ongoing medical colonialism. So that's kind of our first. And then Joanne Fisk and Annette Brown, who I work with in the School of Nursing, Annette Brown, have written a paper on discrediting of Aboriginal subjects, medical subjects, not particularly around birthing in women. So, but in terms of an analytic approach, we have drawn on their work and are just now in the process of thinking about what's important about that for maternity care policy. So this idea that to say you don't get to complain is not about complaining. It is about displacement of women's voices and displacement of citizens. Because although it's about complaining, it's about so much more. And that's where we're going with this. And the larger context of that is, do Aboriginal women have the right to complain? I think is the subtext of that. And I'm sure many of you know the common phrase. I mean, every time I travel somewhere or I talk to somebody, they're, well, it can't be that bad, you know, they get everything for free. And I don't even like saying it because it's just so ridiculous. But the notion that the deservedness of complaining is even undermined by that, right? Medical subject is constructed as unknown and other. And I think what's important about Fisk and Brown's work that is that there are consequences, that terms of reference are set, and alternatives to alternative ways of seeing Aboriginal women are undermined. And that underlying that notion of discredibility or a lack of credibility or discrediting, no right to complain, are value-laden claims. So, and that's how I tend to think of it in teaching ethics and politics and policy and nursing, is that when we help nurses see that every policy and practice and talk and text is value-laden in some way, that doesn't necessarily mean it's in the field of ethics, but what is valued, what is disvalued, what are the values that are underpinning that? We start to think about policy differently. So the right to complain in this instance was constructed on the basis of credibility. Who's got the right to complain, who doesn't? Some women in that moment were constructed as more or less of deserving of the right to complain, which ultimately reduces women's truth and experiences to complaints. So, as we all know, in this moment, this is the truth, right? This is the truth in this moment, versus the notion that all Aboriginal women's voices constitute some other truth in comparison to what non-Aboriginal women would say. So I guess we would conclude by saying the problem, as I see it, as somebody working in the field where the reality is that Aboriginal women's birth and outcomes are significantly significantly worse, is that health inequities and poor birth outcomes in this instant can then be reduced to something like credibility. Now that might seem like a bit of a stretch, but if we're saying, oh, look at how bad the outcomes are, and women don't have a right to complain, we create a whole other set of conditions within which we're going to tackle any of these problems. And in that response, I guess our thinking was is that the problem has shifted back to women. You know, really, the right to complain is really an individualized phenomena. It's not allowing us to attend to this larger context, which where we need to focus our attention. So, and then just finally, I realized, we talked a lot about the discrediting of Aboriginal women, but there was also this valorizing of women's acceptance of birthing, whatever was happening around birthing. So when women said, I guess they know best, and to get the best care, I agreed to be induced. I agreed to go off island early, so my pregnancy was actually okay. They said it's so great. We have such a big family of aunties to help, and how great our culture is for that. So there was I had to push myself, like, okay, I got the discrediting, but what? But they were valorized in compliance and essentialized, their cultural essentialism played out. Well, you've got a lot of support, so it should be okay for you to go, which is valorizing, but in a way that is contradicting and essentializing. So I don't know, I'm trying that one out on you. And I think maybe we'll just stop there because this was maybe just say a couple words about this, Kelly, because Kelly went on her own little inquiry path, and this is where we're going to end.
Of the idea of epistemic authority and privilege, and this group may have more insights into that. Because I actually found this reading in Feminist Standpoint Theory, so I'm probably in the right room for a discussion on that. But the idea that these women were being discredited, I think, sort of comes from a place of privileging some women's knowledge over others. And if you actually privilege some women's knowledge, you're perhaps discrediting or there's deference to another woman's knowledge. So I was sort of playing with those ideas. You can let me know what you think of that. But that's sort of the path I was trying to go down with this.
And particularly with your interest in agency and autonomy, because those get constructed in the bioethical sense of individualized rather than that. So just greetings from all the women that they're here with us. We used to say we won't go anywhere, not together, but it's impractical given where we all live. So I guess our intent is to always do this together, but it's just us today. But so those last ideas are really, I thought, this is a great place to see whether that like is actually making some sense from a logic perspective, but also from a, you know, if you were in that room and you said this, and somebody said, wow, where would you have gone with that? So I'm just curious if you want to just say if you've had a similar experience and where you think we should go, whether you think we've misread the comment. Yeah, please.
In my experience, I don't think that healthcare professionals care at all about the way women feel about their birthing experiences, and this goes for all women overall. They frame it in a very simple context of live babies versus dead babies, and their narrative is that if you accept the maximum in medical treatment that we recommend, your baby will live, and if you don't, your baby will die. That is a very difficult narrative to counteract.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering what you think about in terms of where do you gather do you enter into that discourse at all in order to gain some credibility in the kind of situation that you were talking about, where you say to nurses and doctors and healthcare people, well, this many babies died in this circumstance, and this many babies die in this circumstance. Because frankly, they don't care if the mom has postpartum depression, if the baby lives. Do you know what I mean? So really, the mom's experience at that point, from what I see, really takes a back seat.
It can be a challenge, having worked in the area for a while. But I think, I still feel like there's a place we can get to with them by sharing experiences and by helping them see those experiences as important. I think it does take some numbers sometimes to you know, knowing your audience, right? How to get through them, using some mixed methods to try and in that way. And there's the epidemiology, and then there's the qualitative data. So I don't know, I think sometimes you come at it from a few different directions, I just feel like I just kind of keep knocking on the door and saying.
So do you have those numbers?
Yeah.
There are groups in BC who are working on it. There's
Well, we collected them in the study. I didn't present them here, but I agree. Like, I anticipate, like, whenever we're writing the papers, I anticipate that they're kind of sitting on your shoulder. So for me, it's about you participate in it to disrupt it.
Yes.
So what I didn't show you is what we did. We spoke to a bunch of physicians who, it was an old prenatal Public Health Agency of Canada prenatal conference. And it was, you know, Aboriginal women. Aboriginal women don't access prenatal care, and they're having low birth weight babies because they're not accessing good nutrition. So I didn't show it because I skipped through it, but we mapped out. So this is what the conference is about. So we mapped out, what does it cost a pregnant woman to feed herself in Bella Coola? Has anybody bought milk in Bella Coola? It's like $9 for 4 liters. And the shop buying practices are abominable. So there's 4 rows of chips and a little thing about this big, for I'm exaggerating, but of fresh fruit and vegetables. And everything on this table is no less than $4, $5 a pound, right? So we mapped out what the costs are to eat well for a pregnant or lactating woman. It was 100 and it's in here, I can say. So we mapped it all out. We mapped out welfare costs, and we mapped out the cost in the grocery store. And we put it all on, I mean, for those of us that think qualitatively, it was hard, right? We had all these, you know, government statistics around welfare and nutritional costs, and we mapped it all out at the conference and said, food security, the issue here in these rural communities is one that we're now saying food security, and buying practices. There's a corporate investment in selling a lot of chips and pop, and not representing other food groups, and then even making it affordable, right? So we did that at this conference because I thought, you know what, I can't, the stories matter, but you have to participate in it to disrupt it. So that's what we've done. So we do actually have all the data about births in all the communities, and so I probably didn't give Kelly that when she went off to the conference, but what I usually say is, I mean, there's a whole group working on revising models of maternity care based on exactly those things, numbers of births, skilled attendants. And so we were regularly drawing on those. Because I think if there's only being one birth in the community, you can't lose your own credibility, but you don't stop there. Like, so the nutrition one was perfect. So we put up that slide and said, okay, it costs $700 to feed a family of four on welfare. To feed a family of four based on these Nutrition Canada, you know, parameters around calories, and it was over $900. So here's the cost to feed a family of four, and nobody's pregnant in that because that makes it goes up. And here's what it costs to buy food to meet nutritional standards in Bella Coola, and it was less, right? There wasn't even. So whenever you see the nutritional status prenatal access to prenatal care and linked to low birth weight, that's the one to go, and there was actually, the Globe had something in it recently about access to prenatal care and nutrition and low birth weight babies, because low birth weight is a huge, it's great.
It's a pleasure to hear this research. I've read some papers. I actually work for Duke Nelson. Being closely connected with her program of research.
Oh, what's your name?
Sarah Munro.
Nice to meet you.
And Kelly Beckman.
Cool.
So I'm really curious about this whole notion of care providers just not getting it and clicking in. And I have a question and a comment. So the question is, what kind of knowledge translation or interaction do you or the community-based researchers have with care providers in the community or even decision-makers with health authorities? Mm-hmm. And the second is that I like the turn that you had at the end to looking at epistemic authority and whose knowledge counts.
Yeah.
And I think that it is true that the authority of knowledge that is out there is the medical authority and the policymakers' perspectives on risk. But I think that it's interesting from what I've learned with Jude's research is the care providers in rural communities have a bit of a different perspective that isn't quite that dominant medical perspective. If I can just share a little bit of that.
Absolutely.
In rural communities, the lack of anonymity and the lack of resources and backup from colleagues that work in obstetrics, personal connections between birthing women and care providers, it creates a different level of personal risk for the care providers in the community. So their perspective of, oh my gosh, you're a high-risk woman, we need to send you out because I'm afraid of you having a birth here and everything going wrong, that's couched in oftentimes a sense of fear of personal risk. So if something goes wrong, I'll be blamed. And Old Masset is an example of that, where in that community there have been bad outcomes and people threatening to leave if one ever happens again and they're providing care in the future. So it's much more complex.
Absolutely.
And these differences in perspectives on risk are, I think, something that needs to be shared. So I'm curious to know about the knowledge translation.
Yeah. So just back in terms of working with, you know, it's interesting because we're working with the community researchers are elders and women in the community. And so those of us like that are practicing in healthcare and teaching, we say, okay, we have a pretty good sense of who we need to connect with, right? And, you know, it's such an entrenched, well, they're not going to listen to us, right? Like even going to the director of the health center in Alert Bay, it's like, you know what, I think she will. I think so there's been a lot of resistance in the community to engage with nurses, physicians, and the band council. It's fascinating. And just so my work, so we've had a couple of different reports for Vancouver Island Health Authority to the Aboriginal Health. We're trying to work, but it's so interesting. The women that we work with construct that as kind of our work. And their work is to keep making sure that women's voices are heard, right? So it's an interesting contradiction. And then sometimes we go to do presentations, and we're all standing there, and part of you are like, I'm like, we're like they want. So there's these nuances within community that make it very challenging. And so I absolutely agree. I mean, I am a nurse, right? My work. And I teach nursing, so I need to understand the healthcare provider experience in relation to women's experiences, because it's a whole, right? It's absolutely a whole. So, and I know that I know her work, because she was originally involved way, way, way back when this first started. And I know that they have then taken up that work more explicitly around what it is that's happening for healthcare providers. I mean, that the lack of anonymity is absolutely key. But this working within these communities is being challenging because there's still this sense that what's the point talking to nurses and doctors? They're not going to change. But I think what you've alerted me to is, and maybe I could frame it differently, our current work is, it would be interesting to just understand their experience. Right, because that's a known. That's already got a high position in our work, right? But the constructing of unknown and other is going in two directions, right? But in terms of teaching nurses and healthcare providers, we bring this into our class all the time. So I hope, and in the School of Medicine, I know Betty does a fair amount of work. So I think. But it's not just the singular experience, right? It's very helpful. Thank you. Yes, please.
We are out of time for today's lecture. Yeah. But based on me and thanking Helen and
if anybody wants to ask or wants to stay, I can. And I'll just, I don't know if anybody wants this. It's a CIHR report, but it's got like all the references we used. And if anybody wants a copy of it, it's too big to email. I partly brought it because it's got all the photos and stuff in it. But if you send me an email, I can just ship it over in paper, pick it up here. I can't email it, but just let me know. Thanks for having us. It's great to be here.
I'm sort of the middle discourse around how it's become.